Hi, this is Ben Lowell, and welcome to Back to the Bible Canada with Dr. John Neufeld. We're continuing our series this week, Jesus, Our Sacrifice, with a message titled, The Sin Management Problem. So let's turn in our Bibles to Hebrews 10, 1-4, as we join Dr. Neufeld now.
People over the long haul, well, they just don't know how to manage their sin. I mean, think of it in terms of a manufacturing company that has significant waste in consequence of their product. So, you know, the company might store their waste or bury their waste or seek to purify their waste or recycle it in some fashion or flush it down a stream and pollute the entire environment. See, we all know that this is a problem. We want to live in a modern world. It has bettered our lives in countless ways, but we need to know how to manage the waste and the pollution and the spill-offs. Now, I want to use that picture as an analogy of the sin problem. But as with all analogies, let me say at the outset, this analogy does have built-in weaknesses. It's not as if we in our lives are producing this great product, but have an unfortunate consequence. Now, that's not an adequate picture of the problem of sin. Our sin permeates our entire being. It leaves nothing untouched. And so all of our humanity has been affected by sin. That includes our intellect, our emotions, our affections, our volition, our capacity to choose. It includes our sexuality, even our awareness of self. Everything but everything is touched and twisted by the sin that has invaded our humanity. So in a sense, the analogy of waste management for a manufacturing business, well, that's not a good analogy at all, but in one important sense, the analogy works. That is, there are spin-offs in every life that really do pollute the environment around us. Our relationships are affected. So also are many of the things we do. We allow greed and pride, the desire to be praised and make a name for ourselves, the desire to pleasure ourselves at the expense of virtue, and the way we manipulate others to meet our own needs. I mean, all of that is like an effluent that flows from sinful lives. And so we seek to manage our sin in some fashion. And some seek counseling, and some seek new relationships, that is, just abandon the mess they left behind and start all over again. Some seek a new job, some even look to live in a new part of the world where they can start all over again. Still others seek to do penance, and then there are those that are so burdened they take their own lives. See, sin produces waste, an unintended spillover. It pollutes everything, like the toxic sludge from a large manufacturing plant. And what do we do with it? And that's the question. You know, the Old Covenant had excellent ways of managing sin. And we've talked about that in our study of Hebrews, and that included the sacrifices and offerings, as well as that one day every year that was called the Day of Atonement. The high priest would place his hands on a goat, he'd confess the sins of the people over it, and then he'd send the goat into the wilderness never to be seen again. And that was a way to remind the people that God was merciful and gracious, and that forgiveness was to be found, and that people should seek it out. More than anything, wouldn't it be great if God would place your sins onto a goat and the goat would run away and it would never come back? Oh, that the effects of sin could be dealt with like that. Wouldn't it be wonderful? And as we've seen, the Old Covenant didn't ultimately solve the sin problem. And Hebrews chapter 10 highlights that problem very well. So let's read Hebrews 10, 1-4. For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins? But in these sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. So let's start at the end, the conclusion the writer of Hebrews is coming to. It's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. And I've said this before, but I think it does no harm to repeat it. There are Christians today that have completely misunderstood the Old Covenant. In their estimation, the way people got forgiven in the Old Testament is by going to the tabernacle or the temple, then they'd present their offering and consequently they'd be forgiven. And then they assume that in the New Testament, Jesus, by his sacrifice, is the way that we get forgiven now. Now that leads to a view that there might be something that we can solve or manage about our own sin. Look, the human sinful mind believes there's got to be another way than admitting we're helpless to manage our sin, and without a Savior, we're undone. So notice again, it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. And notice that verse 4 begins with the word for. And so let's go back to what led to the conclusion that the sacrifices offered in the Old Covenant didn't take away sin at all. The first premise is that the law is but a shadow. And here, by the law, the writer of Hebrews means the ceremonial law, the law regarding sacrifices and offering. See, all of that was a shadow and not the reality. That is, the ceremonial law was pointing to something that was greater than itself. And so for this reason, the shadow could never manage sin. Or as the writer of Hebrews says in verse 1, make perfect the one who worshiped at the tabernacle. For if it had, according to verse 2, if the worshiper had been perfected or cleansed from real sin, there would have been no need to continue the sacrificial ritual. Now, those of us who have studied the First Testament law, we might be puzzled at this, because there are some indications that the ceremonial law could take away sins. I mean, perhaps there are those who have studied the law well, and they'll say, look, Hebrews is wrong. There is forgiveness in the ceremonial law. Well, let's get some examples of that. Leviticus 4 is an entire chapter, and it deals with the sin offering. So let me read Leviticus 4, verse 20. Thus shall he do with the bull, as he did with the bull of the sin offering, so he shall do with this. And the priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. You see, Hebrews says you won't be forgiven, but Leviticus 4, verse 20 seems to say they were forgiven. Now let's go forward to Leviticus 16, which is a chapter that deals with the events of the Day of Atonement. Remember that on that day, usually celebrated in our October, the community would do no work. They'd afflict themselves, which means they would fast, and they'd be in mourning as they remembered their sins. And on this day, there is an exception that never happened in any other day. The high priest would enter the Holy of Holies, and he wouldn't die. There was a great deal of preparation to be made for it. On that day, two goats were chosen. One was sacrificed, and one was set loose in the wilderness, signifying that God was driving the goat of sin from the camp. And on that day, the high priest would slaughter a bull for a sin offering himself, and then he'd enter the Holy of Holies and make atonement for himself, and then he'd slaughter another goat and take the blood and make atonement for the people. And what was the outcome of this elaborate ceremony? Well, Leviticus 16, verse 30, in summing up the events of that day, says, "For on this day shall atonement be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean before the Lord from all your sins." And so it seems, simply reading the text of Leviticus, that the blood of bulls and goats really does take away the sins of the people of Israel. Perhaps sin was managed after all. So what gives? How can Hebrews say it wasn't, and Leviticus say, at least at the outset, that it is? And on this note, the critics of the book of Hebrews will say, well, you see, Hebrews is not accurate. And to that, we might think that those ancient Jews that were being tempted, you know, to abandon the Christian faith, thinking that, yeah, they can manage the old sin problem under the old covenant, maybe that's okay. And that also fuels the idea for moderns that perhaps, well, perhaps we don't need something as radical as surrendering our lives to Christ to get our sins forgiven. Perhaps sin can be managed, keep its effects in check, in some fashion, get on with our lives in our way. I mean, after all, isn't there another way to deal with sin? And so it's very important then to take another look at the Old Covenant ceremonial law and do an in-depth analysis. What's actually promised of the worshiper and what's not? What can be done with the sin problem? Now, we start by noticing that in the Mosaic law, two different kinds of sin are being described. Let's go to Numbers chapter 15. Verse 22 begins a long section concerning one of these kinds of sins. And it says, "But if you sin unintentionally and do not observe all the commands the Lord has spoken to Moses." Ah, there it is. See, that seems to give the impression that you didn't mean to commit a sin, but you might have intended something else, but you slipped up. Or let's go forward two verses later, and here I'm reading Numbers 15, 24 to 25. "Then if it was done unintentionally, without the knowledge of the congregation, all the congregation shall offer one bull from the herd for a burnt offering, a pleasing aroma to the Lord, and its grain offering and its drink offering according to the rule, and one male goat for a sin offering, And the priest shall make atonement for all the congregation of the people of Israel, and they shall be forgiven. Because it was, because it was a mistake. And they have brought their offering, a food offering to the Lord, and their sin offering before the Lord for their mistake. See, in order to understand the law, we must answer the question, what's the mistake? And that will help us to understand the nature of the law and what the book of Hebrews is teaching.
If the expert Bible teaching of Dr. John Neufeld 5 days a week on radio and podcast is simply not enough, then you may want to experience the Back to the Bible Canada YouTube channel. For Dr. John's weekly video series, it's the same clear, concise, and faith-provoking preaching, but you get to listen and watch. Browse from dozens of past video episodes, all available 24/7 at no cost to you. Remember to subscribe and hit the notification bell so you never miss a new upload. And could I ask you to leave a comment while you're there? We love hearing your feedback, and your engagement helps spread the program to more eyes and ears. If you'd like to help support the creation of high-quality resources like these, then please consider giving a financial gift. Just call 1-800-663-2425 or visit backtothebible.ca.
In order to understand the Old Covenant, we're going to have to ask and answer what kinds of sins are considered a mistake. Because as I see it in contemporary terms, most people claim that their sins are all mistakes. See, as a pastor, I occasionally talked with people who have described their sins exactly that way. Let me replay an actual conversation I once had with a man. He had committed adultery. At least as best as I remember it, this is how it goes. This man had had prostate surgery, and consequently, at least as he put it, he said he didn't think he was capable of relations anymore. And so he said, my guard was down. And so he described how he had had sexual relations with a colleague at work, and he told me, without flinching, he was really surprised that he was even capable of it. But he said, I'm sure you can see, it was all a mistake. I didn't mean to commit adultery. I didn't think I was capable of it. You know, as bizarre as that story is, when you think about it, a great many people who break the seventh commandment describe it as a mistake. I wasn't planning it, they say. Things got out of hand. It was a mistake. And so they look for ways to manage their sin by saying, it's not a big deal. At least it isn't if I didn't plan it. And perhaps my spouse will understand that. Well, here's the important question. Are they right? And for the purpose of our own study, when the law speaks about unintentional sins, is that what it has in mind? Or to put it more practically, does the Old Covenant specify what it means when it calls a sin an unintentional sin? See, I think the best place to begin our study is to go back to Leviticus chapter 4. You might remember that I began the question of the forgiveness of sins in the Old Covenant by quoting from this chapter, Leviticus 4 verse 20, and the priest shall make atonement for them and they shall be forgiven. See, what I didn't say when I quoted from that chapter is very clear about the kinds of sins that are forgiven. So let's go to the beginning of the chapter, verses 1 and 2. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about the things not to be done, and does any one of them. See, that's the context of the chapter that promises forgiveness. The forgiveness only relates to unintentional sins. Now, before we go on, we might remember, since the text says this relates to any of the Lord's commands about things not to be done, and yet one makes a mistake and does what is forbidden. See, we need to remember there are a great many commands in the law that relate to a great many different kinds of violations. Let's, for our purposes, just consider some of the laws that come from Leviticus. The first seven chapters gives laws, instructions, as to how each sacrifice is to be presented before the Lord. Don't make any mistakes on this. Chapter 11 contains laws as to which animals might be eaten and which animals might not be eaten. And so there's a long list of forbidden animals, ones that are considered unclean. Some birds are permitted to be eaten, others are forbidden. then on to winged insects, and then swarming animals that swarm on the ground like rats and mice and lizards and the like. There is a law as to what must be done to any pot or vessel in which one of these small animals might fall into and die. The vessel will be unclean, and then there are laws as to how to ritually cleanse that pot or dish. And then laws concerning clothing, which might have touched one of the dead animals. And the next chapter, Leviticus 12, deals with laws of ritual purification for a woman after the birth of a child. Then in chapters 13 and 14 deals with leprosy, what must be done if one has been healed, how ritual cleansing must then be performed. Indeed, even houses that have some kind of disease in the walls, you know, in modern terms, we might think of things like black mold inside the walls, that kind of thing. How is such a house to be cleansed? And it turns out there are laws about that. And then Leviticus chapter 15 speaks about bodily discharges and the kind of ritual purification a person has to undergo after such an event. Well, I think you're getting the point. There were laws concerning the kind of seed you're allowed to sow in your field, the kinds of food you're allowed to eat, laws about what kind of clothing you are permitted to wear, and that you could not mix two kinds of fabric in one garment. I'm trying to give the impression of a long list of laws in which the average person would begin to lose track. So let's get back to the principal message, which, as you remember, is in Leviticus chapter 4, verse 13. If the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and they realize their guilt. So stop here. See, in this case, it's not just an individual, it's the entire community. They as a whole did not know that what they were doing was in violation to the law, and now suddenly they're made to realize it. And that's the context for the words that we read earlier from Leviticus chapter 4, verse 20. When any of these unintentional sins are done, then you take a bull and you sacrifice it as a sin offering, and then the people are forgiven. Theologian H.H. Rowley said the following: "The law is much concerned with involuntary acts and ritual uncleanness where no ethical considerations were involved. That is, a person didn't know they were ritually unclean, and then they did a certain thing an unclean person could not do. It was unintentional, but now they know it. And in such a case, animals are sacrificed, they're forgiven. And that and only that is what's meant by an unintentional sin. Unintentional sins were never, as some of us use the term today. I don't mean to take the Lord's name in vain, we say, but it just kind of slipped out. It was unintentional. That's not what's meant here. Now hold your breath, because we're getting to the point. There is another entirely different set of sins, and these are called defiant sins. Or more literally, these are the sins that are done with a hand lifted up in a clenched fist of defiance before God. Literally, they're called high-handed sins. And there are many examples of that in the law. One example is found in Leviticus 20, verses 6 to 27, and it's a long list, and it includes the person who consults mediums and necromancers. It includes adultery, homosexuality. It includes sex with animals. Well, there's another list in Numbers 35, 16 to 32. There, the list includes striking a person with an object in your hand so that the person dies. And that's called murder, and it's a high-handed sin. And by the way, you can find that breaking any one of the Ten Commandments was always considered to be a high-handed sin, not an unintentional sin. The law would utterly condemn the person, that one that came to my office, the one I told you about, that said, "Look, I didn't know I could enjoy intimacy, and so it was an accident." No. All adultery is a high-handed sin. So is misusing the sacred name of God. So is worshiping an idol, entertaining another god, breaking the Sabbath, envying your neighbor's property. I hope you're getting the idea. So what's to be done about those kinds of sins? Well, Deuteronomy 17, 12 to 13, which calls high-handed sins presumptuous sins, tells us what should be done. It says, "The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God, or the judge, that man shall die. So you shall purge the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again." And that's it. No sacrifice in the tabernacle or later the temple could deal with the presumptuous sins of rebellion. Only one thing remained, and that's condemnation and death. Unless the rest of the community see as this person is put to death, they should see it and they should fear. And so it turns out the writer of Hebrews had it spot on. The blood of bulls and goats can't take away sins, at least not the high-handed ones. You can sacrifice all you want, your sin will remain. As Ezekiel said, the soul who sins, he shall die. And so it's possible to speak of God's forgiveness on two levels. The Levitical sacrifice, climaxing in the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16, made it possible for God to forgive in the sense that he withheld the full measure of his wrath against his people. It was, in a sense, that the wrath was postponed. Hebrews 9:13, if you remember, it spoke about the cleansing of the flesh, outward purification, but that was it. Remember Hebrews 10, verse 1? Those daily and yearly sacrifices could never make perfect in the sense of cleansing them from high-handed sins. And here's the truth of the matter. We've all committed presumptuous sins, and the blood of bulls and goats can't take away sins. And the writer of Hebrews wasn't ignorant of the law. He was an expert at it. There is no sin management system that will pass the sniff test. No sacrifice in the temple will do that. Neither will moving onto a new relationship or moving into a foreign country or going to counseling or getting into a physical exercise program, any form of penance, anything, even taking your own life. None of it will take away your sin. There is no way to manage the waste, the effluent of human sin. What we need is not a way to manage sin. We need someone who can save us from sin. His name is Jesus, and his sacrifice is superior to all else.
Thanks for your message, John. Let me ask you, why do you think people are so bent on dealing with their own sin or ignoring it rather than coming to Christ?
Yeah, one word, pride. We just believe that we can solve the problem. To come to Christ and to say, I've messed up so badly, I don't even know where to begin. I've got no way of solving the sin sludge that comes out of my life. I can't do a thing about it, and I'm hopeless and helpless before you. I think that pride leads a great many people away from the only solution that's offered them. And so they continue to wander around in their own sin. No matter how bad it gets, they won't turn to Christ. So I think we need to say to people continually over and over again, before you come to the cross, you need to humble yourself and you need to forsake your pride and come to Christ.
Thanks so much, John. And remember to join us again tomorrow as we continue our series, Jesus, Our Sacrifice, right here on Back to the Bible Canada, Bible teaching you can trust. This year, once again, we are so pleased to be able to partner in facilitating Bible teaching conferences for pastors across India. Thousands of pastors have actively participated in the past, and Dr. John Neufeld will once again be the prominent Bible teacher. The stories we've encountered of pastors journeying long distances to participate have fueled our commitment to partner in these events. Can we invite you to share a financial gift specifically to support the development of pastors' Bible teaching skills and, by extension, their impact upon their churches? With a gift of $70, your sponsorship will cover a pastor's necessary travel, accommodation, meals, Bible resources, and registration. Would you consider joining us this month to sponsor an Indian pastor or several in attending a Bible teaching conference in one of three different locations this summer? To do so, visit us at backtothebible.ca or call 1-800-663-2425.